Thank you. And a lot of this will have almost nothing to do with what I do in my real life, because like many academics, I'm doing 5 projects and have a little time here and there. Honestly, the World Trade Center, I spent half my time. I spent a significant amount of time working with the Veterans Administration also. And another little project, which I'll refer to just because it fits well into what we're talking about here, because you'll see some statistics here that may not be completely impressive, but if you understand post-traumatic stress disorder and the way you describe the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, you'll understand that sometimes it's difficult. And so I'll compare this with another project I'm doing for people that know Apache, the ICU severity and length of stay system. I've done some work on writing rule sets in SNOMED to try to get the Apache diagnosis. Obviously, ICU admissions are a lot more straightforward than PTSD signs and symptoms. So I'll kind of talk a little bit about that here. just real quick to do, you know, the disclaimer parts of it. The PI and co-PI in this project was Diane Montella, MD, and Ted Spiroff, PhD, both at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Vanderbilt. Steve Brown, Peter Elkin, spent a lot of work on this project. Fern Fitzhenry, James Jackson, Mike Matheny, Elliot Faustine, Vincent Messina, one of their programmers, and Inlai Wong, who's one of our programmers back here. And this is how I move it forward? Or do I push a button? Okay. Good. PTSD, everybody knows what that is, and I'm also interested in this because of my association with the World Trade Center as we start looking at post-traumatic stress disorder in the first responders. So I'm you know, doing double duty here with PTSD, kind of becoming a very familiar with PTSD and what it's all about. Of course, on the VA side, PTSD being one of those signature diseases of the Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraq and Iran. Afghanistan and Iraq. failure to diagnose or treat, let me say one other thing. We did TBI at the same time as we did PTSD. So if I discuss a little bit of TBI, it's only because we did them together in one experiment. But I'm going to talk about the PTSD. Failure to diagnose and treat PTSD in a timely manner, of course, may lead to physical or mental illness. Obviously, there are, you know, we've heard of and seen these veterans who have a post-traumatic stress disorder, and of course, their physical health deteriorates at the same time because of the failure to take care of themselves, to eat properly. They're hurting themselves, that type of thing. Substance abuse, unemployment, and violence against themselves or others, their family members, their children, others in the community. The project aim was to utilize the common VA compensation and pension exams, otherwise known as the C&P exams, as a platform for developing and testing text processing to detect terminology for signs, symptoms, and manifestations that represent the case definitions, i.e. using the DSM-IV criteria, using the free text notes out of the C&P exams, parsing them, and then seeing if we can identify PTSD candidates out of those records. It was done as a cross-sectional study utilizing the C&P reports, as I said. So what we did basically was use the natural language processor that Peter Elkin and I use in our lab, the MCVS, to take those free text records, parse them all. Has anybody seen that in action yet in here? Okay, I guess I could have stuck a couple more slides in there to show what that's about. But if you can imagine, we take the whole record, we parse it, we index it. So we already have some idea of all of the knowledge that's contained in that free text record. Then we can go back and query that indexed record for signs and symptoms, for rules, for anything else that we might be looking for. We used a training set of 50, a test set of 150 exams. These were all patients that were confirmed PTSD patients. At this point, the project is still in process, but at this point, we took confirmed PTSD, confirmed TBI, so that we could set up the training sets, test against it, and make sure that in fact it's possible to do it appropriately or accurately. 10 records then were human reviewed, looking for true positive, false negative to get positive predictive value and sensitivity. I don't think we did any specificity calculations, but we did positive predictive value and sensitivity. Like I said, note that there was TBI patients also that we did this on in the same cohort. Does anybody know the DSM-IV criteria? So nobody's worked in this space. That's okay. It's actually quite interesting, and there's a number of scales. It's debatable which one's the best, but this is the one we chose. And basically what it looks at from the perspective of PTSD is you can see criterion A1, the person experienced, witnessed, or was confronted with an event or events that involved actual or threatened death or serious injury or threat to the physical integrity of self or others. You can see criterion 2. Now, the thing that should jump out at to you, should jump out from these criterion is these aren't as easy as what was their blood pressure and what was their temperature. These are very complicated concepts to try to track down. Now we're talking about free text records. So someone is describing, for example, in criterion A1 that the person experienced, witnessed, or was confronted with an event or events that involve actual or threatened death or serious injury, a description of a rape, a description of a physical assault. Someone was beaten, someone was kicked, someone was thrown to the ground. All could potentially qualify as a criterion A1 type of event. So it's, and you take this in contrast to doing diagnosis in, for example, that Apache project that I've been working on, where it's pretty clear that someone has certain diagnosable, very objective kind of measures. So this was a real challenge for us. And honestly, I just have a blast with these kind of rules, trying to figure out, you know, what are the 20 ways that you can describe an automobile, a Humvee, ATV, whatever. So you can see there, response involved fear, helplessness, or horror, intrusive, distressing recollections of event, including images, thoughts, and perceptions, dreams, flashbacks, etc. acting or feeling as if the event were still happening, psychological distress, efforts to avoid thoughts, feelings, or conversations, etc. I'll leave it there just for a second, but hypervigilance, having to write rules for what hypervigilance is and how it's described in a medical record. So in considering how to construct these rules, and I'll kind of show you how this was done in this case in a little bit, we had to consider the flexibility of the rules. For example, many times you have to consider whether or not you're going to explode down the SNOMED hierarchy. However, if it explodes down to 50 additional terms, you might have to exclude a couple of those terms because they just don't fit. So you've got to have the ability to write rules where you can include something but exclude maybe a couple of children out of there. They must include the positive, negative, and uncertain assertions. If you are merely looking for text matches, then if they didn't witness something, if they didn't witness a beating, it would register in a text search as the same as did witness a beating. So it doesn't, you have to have that ability. And the rules must be able to express explosion or drill down in terms. So you can be more precise, less precise. And one thing I didn't include here is the ability to either, in the case of many times when we're doing this type of thing, is consider, do you create a synonym for an automobile accident to be a Humvee accident, or do you do a text match on Humvee and look for Humvee accidents? So you've got to consider that. You've got to allow for actual text matching even in the rules development. And then I'll show you that in a little bit. So an example, stepping back just a second, back to that criterion A1, if you consider a rule that captures A1, experienced, in quotes, witnessed, in quotes, or confronted with, actual or threatened, is a fairly difficult concept to describe in many cases, never mind capture in a rule. So you can see what we did was, one of the first things we did was we tried to say, what does this mean? And so with the criterion A1 rules, with experienced witness or confronted with, et cetera, et cetera. We broke this down and said there's components in here of abuse, combat slash war, death, accidents, harmful entities, reportable medical events. And so under abuse, we started with abuse, rape, sexual trauma, privation, war, combat, bioterrorism. And we tried to create these lists of descriptions for psychological conditions that were, like I said, it was a lot of fun, but we had three or four people sitting around trying to figure out, you know, how do you describe this? How do you talk about this? What's it going to look like in a medical record? And then we essentially put that in an English language rule to start with. But this is where I was talking about how the machine rule ends up looking, is we say, here's the SNOMED code. I'm not even sure what 2506402 is. If anybody knows that, please let me know, because we got to find some place to lock you away. And then we have the assertional options, positive, uncertain, negative, 74 being positive or insertion, et cetera, et cetera. We have record section, the ability to look at just certain sections of records or the whole record if we want to, and explode it or have an exact match. So if I, in fact, put in a word like Humvee, I would put a zero in there and say I want an exact match for Humvee, which has its own problems because sometimes people spell Humvee wrong. And a little more background on the VA, if no one has worked with the VA, the physicians enter their records directly in with their own little typewriting fingers. So you get all sorts of interesting acronyms. I don't think many of them know how to use a spell checker, or it's not available in Vista. I'm just not sure. So a lot of misspellings, a lot of strange things that you see in there. So you can see here for abuse, you can see what we had created earlier when we described abuse was abuse or privation, and or rape, or sexual trauma, or sexual abuse. And then on the right, you can see the machine rule, this or this, or in the case of raped, we had to use a text match for raped. Sexual trauma, there's no concept in SNOMED that equates to sexual trauma. Same thing with sexual abuse. So those would have to be text match words, and you can see where I said the exact match would be that zero there. So same thing with deadly. But you can see with deadly it gets a little more complicated because now we're starting to nest concepts inside of each other, ands, ors, nots, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine the fun time we have here. I think this should happen down at like the Student Union building over a bottle of wine when you build these things, because it's long and it's complicated. But I, like I said, it's actually a lot of fun. Our findings in this was a positive predictive value of 78% with an overall sensitivity of 52%. Like I said, with that sensitivity, it's a little low, but the thing is, these are very difficult concepts to grasp. So the positive predictive value being, if those of you that are statistical nerds, true positive over true positive plus false positive or type 1 errors, right? Means, you know, we did pretty good with the true positives. Unfortunately, because some of those concepts we didn't catch, it affected the sensitivity a little bit, which is setting the bar at a starting point of 52% sensitivity we didn't feel too bad about, because now we go in and we can refine the rules, which we're currently working on. So we're starting at doing pretty good, knowing that once we take a look at what happened and refine the rules, we're going to do much better. So we feel very good about the initial results. Like I said, it allowed us to establish the lower limit for estimating the validity. And just, you know, FYI, the symptom clusters with greater rule extraction, the TBI picked up the cognitive as the highest, the PTSD, the affective, and the affective being more of the psychological type of factors. And I think that's probably what you'd expect, of course. And we still haven't actually looked at these differences maybe being reflective in the way the data is captured in the compensation and pension reports. One of the issues also with the VA is there tends to be a lot of run-on and not much templating of their documents. So there's almost got to be some pre-processing done. So next steps and conclusions. I'm going faster than I thought I'd go, so that's the good news. This project demonstrates opportunities and potential for text mining of the electronic health record. Like I said, going back to the Apache, we're looking at sensitivities and specificities in the 90s because we have a more objective type of a target that we're shooting at. If we're shooting at somebody that came in with COPD, it's much easier to know a COPD than to know sexual abuse or a PTSD diagnosis. It's just a different animal. So it's looking real positive, but there are some limitations in psychological stuff. I mean, the fact is that how easy is it anyways to diagnose PTSD? At the World Trade Center, you know, it's hard for us to see PTSD because the patients can give whatever answers they think they want to give you. If it's a police officer that's at risk of losing his gun, he may flat out lie to you about his symptoms. Not as easy as taking someone's temperature. We're working on developing longitudinal models for the text processing, so actually being able to see amount of time, date that it happened, date that the symptom manifested itself, et cetera. Like I said, there needs to be some pre-processing, pre-coordination, so that we can make it a little more informatics friendly. This would be in the case of VA records, which tend to be a little more wild and woolly than where I did the Apache work, which was at Mayo Clinic, and everything was very structured inside the document. The sections were well defined. the dictation made sure that the words were spelled correctly, et cetera, et cetera. we'll be exploring methods to better standardize or transform the records into a more templated format. So, like I just said, exploring a better synonymy and creating synonyms. Our technology has the ability to have synonyms for words. So, like for example, automobiles, armored personnel carriers, Humvees, Hummers, all are automobiles if it's an automobile accident. And so the conclusions are that NLP-based equality surveillance is practical. This is, you know, doing diagnosis of PTSD, doing Apache. One of my goals, my personal goals, was to actually look at, can we do equality there? So can we start putting quality indicators in? Can we start putting global triggers and start writing rules to surveil records for that, as well as, you know, biosurveillance or surveilling for H1N1, et cetera. With good rule sets, with good case definitions, it's very practical. It's actually quite an inexpensive process. training set and test set methodology should be used for rule validation. We haven't gotten to that point with this particular project yet, but we're in the process of that. And as I said, you know, we're working, there's more work needing to be done in improving the sensitivity and specificity, especially in the psychological type of diagnoses. So that's it for me, which leaves Peter plenty of time if he wants it. Anyone have any questions?
Auto magic. Do you want me to introduce you, or?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Our final speaker today is Dr. Peter Elkin. He's a professor of medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He's the Center Director of Biomedical Informatics and the Vice President of Mount Sinai Hospital for Biomedical and Translational Informatics. Dr. Elkin has been working in biomedical informatics since 1981. That's a long time. And has been actively researching health data representation since 1987. He's a primary author of the American National Standard Institute's National Standard on Quality Indicators for Controlled Health Vocabularies, or ASTMET087. So, if you understand that, but take it away. Thank you.
Oh, sure. Okay. I thought she was going to read my whole bio. I was scared. Thank you for that kind introduction. That was great. I should speak in the microphone. Is that the... Oh, there's a lavalier too. Can I use that? Is that all right? Okay, thanks. Oh, thank you, Brett. I appreciate it. May I? Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name's Peter. I have been interested in public health informatics since I became a professional in medicine. And one of the things by the way, I'm sorry you got the room late. Mark Tuttle is part of our group, sent me to the wrong room, and I thought it was a fascinating presentation, but it just wasn't ours. So then I realized, oh my gosh, it's the wrong stuff. I better get here. So yeah, and part of the reason was I'm going to show you some of the things that are preludes to Brett. So I feel sad that I didn't get to do that. But anyway, so we have a number of collaborators on this: Dave Froling, Dietlin Rodler, Brett, of course, who you just heard from, Gail Welsh, Trent Rosenblum, Ted Spiroff, and Steve Brown, who all helped in this. And this stemmed from a basic question. And here's the question. The question was, we thought first, if we build it, will they come? Okay. Second thing I did was I said, okay, if we build it and they come, can they use it? Okay, so here's what's it? It is, if we give people the ability to ask any question they'd like from clinical records or from clinical data, you know, from an epidemiological perspective, are they currently trained and competent to use it? Now, I'll show you who the sample was and everything and who we picked and what actually went on. But we have a sort of answer to that question for you. I'm just, for those of you who don't know us, we actually, this is a Facebook group. If you're Web 2.0 enabled, please join. A lot of your friends have Biomedical Informatics Research Collaborative. And Jan Tallman, who's part of our group, did a mind map for us. And we found out we had lots of smart people, lots of people who are smarter than us. And we've got a lot of good press. They even quoted us, you know, with Obama's agenda in the lay press. And this is a paper by Steve Brown showing, which we think is the first article in the whole literature on fully automated electronic quality monitoring ever. So we think that was good. And that was VA data, like what we showed you before, showing that it was feasible. And here's Brett's book, which he didn't show you, but I'll shamelessly show you in case you want to increase his stock on Amazon. And we are interested in this, what we call intelligent electronic health records, where it empowers you to use the chart to think with you about public health care. And we want to basically take data, analyze it, get information, take that information and apply it to populations and get knowledge. And then we take that knowledge and we combine it with two pieces of knowledge to learn something we could not have known from either piece of knowledge separately. And then we get intelligence. And that, we believe, leads to better public health response. So, okay, you have... Now, you heard a lot about SNOMED. Let's say we have two sets of clinical records and they're all encoded in SNOMED. Now we have basis of comparison, and we do this with inside of models like CDA inside of the RIM in order to give it a healthcare purview. And then that is the basis for multi-center data sharing, interchange HIEs, NHANs, and then eventually national policies for aggregate data handling. So, you know, if you care about this, eventually what happens is you get down into the mud with us, and the idea is that we take the instance data people have and we index it by both ontologies and by assertional knowledge. And then we have a general expert system shell, which we're going to show you, and then people can write queries against it. And what we're here to talk about in direct part is, after we get you to understand what the experiment was about, is are people currently trained well enough to be able to do this on their own? And you're guessing probably already what the answer is, but we're going to break it down a little bit more. So this is a conceptual relativity. It's sort of based on, this happens to be the GI hierarchy in SNOMED, but each line, at the length of the line, is the formal conceptual distance between each of the concepts, and it's a compositional function. So you can say, okay, show me all the cases within some fixed distance of this one, and it'll show you all those cases. And because it's compositional, it works over any range of case definitions that you want. And it's new math we're publishing, and we think it's pretty cool. We're pre-computing all the distances in SNOMED now, and it's been running on a supercomputer for a month and a half so far, and still hasn't finished, so we're eventually we'll get it. It's just for those of you who care about complexity, it's 370,000 times 369,999 over 2 is the number of comparisons, right? So it's got like 10 to the 6 times 10 to the 12th comparisons to do. So it's going to take a little while to finish. But and then hopefully we'll be able to get these intelligent agents, these two-headed guys, to walk through the data and find co-occurrences and important, you know, information to generate knowledge from our data sets that we would have never thought to ask about before. And this gets you down to ontologies. Okay, so here's down in the mud knowledge representation where I work. And this is the HL7 reference information model. It talks about entities, their roles, role relationships, some participation, some act, which has act relationships. You can fly to the moon with this just as well as you can order a prescription. Okay, this is a level 2 ontology. It's domain specific. It has clinical states, which we separated from the patient. We thought that was smart. Single episode of care, which has encounter, non-encounter events, go through privileged clinicians, completely secure record based on the ISO and the ASTM standards. And then it has, you know, things we talk about in medicine, like procedures and diagnoses and results and orders and prescriptions, adverse reactions, but it doesn't have any of the data or the details. And the level 3 ontology is the details. This is consistent with the level 1 and level 2 ontologies for health, but it has to be gathered through the usual process of care. So I'm going to show you a little bit about that. This is what Brett was alluding to before. So here's a record. It's not a real record. It's like when I would have dictated my practice. I'm an internist. But you can see there's an implied structure but no real structure. And what we do with that record, for those of you who have not seen this before, is we parse it and you get out basically a fully encoded clinical record. It misses some things. All the blue things are positive assertions, red things are negative assertions, green things are uncertain assertions, and it's all in standards. This is a CDA format. It's the concept code in SNOMED. Hypertension is a negative assertion. It becomes hypertensive disorder, systemic arterial. Then we build compositional expressions. So 20-pack year smoking history becomes a finding of tobacco smoking behavior, is modified by pack years, has quantity value 20, is qualified by history of, and that's now computable. Okay, so we take the utterances, and there's, for those of you who work in this, you know there's a clear mismatch between clinical speak and the granularity of the ontologies, and it's, we heard about, you know, just using Boolean logic and pain or tenderness as a simple example of that. It gets much more complicated when you look at the 3 pages of rules in DSM-IV for PTSD. I mean, and they're very long descriptions and very qualitative. And if you look, I sit on the Common Formats panel for NQF, and I can tell you that many of the NQF measures that are mandated for meaningful use will also be qualitative and have, you know, very nuanced and ways of gathering data for this, and so we're all faced with this in a way that's imminent and important. But I think also it speaks to clinical expressivity, and that is where the richness of, you know, EIS in public health can really be brought to bear on the problems of the, you know, of emerging infectious diseases and so forth. That's why strong partnerships, I think, at the CDC, across the divisions was really, really essential to getting buy-in for the dissemination of good work like Dan's doing and others, right? So here we go. So here, this is clinical records, gets lots of data. It doesn't get everything, as you can see, but the things we're not getting already, we are working on. You can see that the lion's share of the data is captured. This one clinical note has over 840 concepts in it. This is an uncertain assertion. Everything's broken up into positive, negative, uncertain assertions. This is actually a 7-valued logic under it for the uncertain assertions, but that's another talk. And then what we do is we create the compositional expressions. I show you this one because it's a pure description logic one, which shows the mismatch between the granularity of right anterior cruciate ligament injury and how it gets represented. Of course, we only store the codes, not the text, so it's computable. It's very compact. But the idea of this, then you have description logic wrapped in Boolean logic, wrapped in description logic, ad infinitum, as much as you need to do to represent the material. Okay, so now you know what we were talking about. So now we have this both in XML and relational forms, and so our study works from there. So it's basically, you know, there's unstructured text, gets parsed in CDA, then gets parsed into the details of the record, then we have audit tools, basically. And that's in case the thing didn't come up. And okay, so we're we're trying to get this stake in the ground so people know where they need to go. And this is, we believe, where the 21st century is pointing us, is in fully computable data. This happens to be our hardware architecture. I don't have infinite time. One of them in the slides if you need it. Here is a basic caricature of how things work. Someone dictates or types in a record, hits against a terminology server, which is here, sends codes, which get stored in the MR repository. They've done this, of course, in their native language, which for me is English. Hard to tell, I know. So here the records, if you want to do a query, same thing. You talk in English, you don't talk in SNOMED, and then it goes against the terminology server, gets the codes from SNOMED, matches code against code, and you just get back the right retrieval, so very sensitive and specific retrieval, but you don't have to know anything about SNOMED. Now I'm going to show you where that's actually a little bit funny for actually authoring things. So SNOMED is a description logic-based terminology. It's a compositional system. It comes out of the box with about 370,000 concepts and a million terms. We add actually another 790,000 terms to it to make it clinically relevant, because pathologists don't talk like the rest of us, basically. And then over 30, it's actually now 60 million indices to make it run fast. And compositional expressions are like Legos. I love that because my kids play with Legos. Legos, you know, you can take small numbers of pieces and build things that have greater functionality than the sum of their parts. And like that, compositional expressions are the same. So here are four unimpeachable guys at Mayo, where I was till recently. And this is William Warhol, Mayo father, Will Charlie, and Henry Plummer, the first internist. And they may say the same thing, but say it differently. And what we do is we output a standard structure based on meaning. So you're aggregating at the level of meaning. So, thank you. So I wanted to make this public health. This is what I thought of when I saw that. There we are. So this is just a little commentary. Can anybody tell me who this patient is? No, of course not, right? Because so this is a UUID, basically, although I didn't put the long one in there. And then it's matched to some unique identifier that's stored in a really deep freeze way where it takes two people to unlock it. And then this is all that gets sent, I would think should get sent to public health. And what happens here is it takes care of all the non-HIP identifiers. So you just send SNOMED codes. And then if you say SNOMED codes, you've got everything you need to know to do public health inquiry against the patient. You've got patient, document, section, subsection, problem, sentence, compositional expression, concept level detail, right here. But none of the story. So if it's the mayor's wife or the captain of the football team, all those non-HIP identifiers gone. All you send is the medical information, which are the codes. Still important. And then, of course, you do the usual public health tricks for privacy and security. So if you get less than 8 retrievals in a jurisdiction, you don't show it, you know, and just show aggregated data. But there are a lot of ways to make more acceptable what we're going to send to public health centrally from local and state public health, and then have it be able to be re-identified for a public health response. So this is what I just said on this slide. So basically, we had some funding from BioSense that helped us to do some of these experiments. And BioSense, as you know, as of June of last year, had 558 hospitals, a bunch of Veterans Affairs and Defense ones. They were transmitting chief complaints or diagnoses. And we had some of them that actually sent radiographic reports. And so you know, guys understand the Category 8 bioterrorism agents. We're now thinking about swine flu, but we're thinking about inhalational anthrax, which is an ILI, tularemia, avian flu, plague, and these things are available sooner than laboratory-confirmed diagnosis. In terms of the flu, only 8% of people get tested, so laboratory-confirmed data really doesn't give you a population view, even though it's the highest quality data. And we have another piece of work that showed that the symptoms actually map very closely with the actual flu season, both in numbers and geographically. So here's what we did for our case definitions. We had an interface for subject matter experts to use independently to create case definitions that would be stored in a computable form. We wanted to minimize the need for these subject matter experts to have knowledge of the underlying ontologies that were used in the case definitions. We wanted them to understand their field and how to use a little bit of logic, some Boolean logic at least. And then we wanted them to be able to automatically validate the compositional expressions that are generated automatically, and then differentiate their they had to be able to know when to ask for positive assertions, negative assertions, uncertain assertions, and combinations. You know, positive and negative, negative and uncertain, positive and uncertain. And then they needed a usable interface that they could work with. And so this is a picture of an interface where you just type in whatever you want, and then you can specify whether you want it to be positive, negative, uncertain, explode the concept or not. And we had to explain what that meant to them. Exploding, of course, meant to use all the subterms, the subtypes, as well as the index concept that they were using. And then what section of the record they wanted to search, because they could search any section of the record that was indexed. And then they would use Boolean logic to put these together. And then here's an example of a flu, or part of flu case definition. We had sore throat and cough and fever linking the Boolean logic. And we show this for them to validate, but it actually runs off the codes like Brett showed you for his project. And so this was, we thought, a simple interface. You pick things and then you combine them with Boolean logic, then you drag and drop them up into the top bucket, and I don't think we have internet access or I could run it, and then you can actually run it against any data set. So we had a number of different data sets that we had, and you just submit it and you get the records back, okay? And then we looked at these. So first I'd like to talk about, before I tell you what the answers were, what are some of the reasons for very hard to use systems, okay, including these kinds of systems? Well, sometimes the development emphasis was on the machine and system rather than the user. Also, that the target audience is always a moving target, that there's a lack of design verification, the science versus common sense, and then the development teams sometimes are not well integrated, so sometimes you don't have ways to put these things together, and that the skills necessary for the interface design are fundamentally different than the skills necessary for the technical implementation, the underlying knowledge representation. So these were things we struggled with as we did the users. So we got back to user-centered design, which requires an early focus on the users and their tasks. It requires an empiric measurement of the product usage. And it required an iterative design cycle, which is what we've been going through. So we designed, tested, modified, redesigned, and this was part of the testing that went through that iterative user-centered design process, the data that I'm going to show you in a second, which is, you'll see. So first, there's a number of types of human factors analysis, including contextual inquiry, which is understanding the user's needs, which many of us do. But competitive usability evaluations are not done routinely, and we should actually move toward doing this for all of our software. And this exposes gaps in existing systems. And then you can do low fidelity prototyping, which is rapid turnaround of identified program changes. And occasionally you need large audiences like this one to get, or modified focus groups, to get an understanding of the relevant workflows and processes. So I don't know if you're familiar with human factors engineering. Usability studies are just one type, but usability studies is a time when the developers and the evaluators get together, okay? They observe without intervention, okay? They get the developers get to feel the user's pain. They come to grips with imperfection. They resist the impulse to blame the user. Then they have to next resist the impulse to blame themselves, which necessarily follows. And then eventually there's acceptance, you know, that's liberating and it leads to progress. So usefulness is a combination of both utility and usability. And usability is easy to learn, efficient to use, easy to remember, a few errors, and also subjectively pleasing. So you've got to like working with it in order for it to do a good job for you. So what you're going to see in terms of results are a combination of functionality and usability. And I'll show you what we're doing about it a little bit too. So a usability study is a usable, reproducible study of a consumer product or process interactions conducted in a controlled yet simulated environment. So here's the usability lab at Mayo that we used. It's a lab, has a control room here. These are one-way mirrors. The people work in here, and it's a think-aloud process. The control room just has the study coordinator and one person who's like the help desk person. And back here, everybody's crammed in. They've got their food, and everybody's watching and complaining. And there's large TVs in here, so you can watch what's going on in here. But this person who's doing the study doesn't know anything about who's in the back. So there are actually ISO standards for this. There's a human centered design development lifecycle. It's ISO 13407, and it talks about the human centered process, understanding and specifying, evaluating designs, iteratively specifying the requirements, producing design results, and evaluating the systems. In this particular study, we had four informatics faculty that were asked independently to model a set of 10 questions to determine the inter-rater reliability of the case definition construction process, including the tool. And we had actually broken this up into three categories. We thought three of the questions were simple, we thought three of the questions were complex, and we thought four of the questions were moderate. So we designed it this way. So you can see the questions here. So simple question was like, of the patients who had a myocardial infarction, how many were on aspirin? Okay. Right, you epidemiologists already think, what's the inclusion-exclusion criteria for this? What's the critical question, right? That's what they were told to do. And these are all scientists, right? And then some of the moderately difficult questions were like, of the people who'd had an AMI, how many had chest pain comparing the population with diabetes and the non-diabetic population, right? Which we know should differ, right? Absolutely. Myocardial infarctions without chest pain are much more common in the diabetic population than the non-diabetic population. And then for the hard ones, we had true comparison. So here we had compared the rate of pneumonia in patients who received the pneumococcal vaccine versus patients who had not received the pneumococcal vaccine. So there was a two-group comparison where we had to run the system inclusion-exclusion criteria and then the critical question and get a ratio for both and then compare the two ratios, right? So this is what they were basically asked to do. So as you're doing this, we started affectionately calling it rule meistering because it became a fun little professional affectation. They were the rule meisters. And as Brett said, with wine and everything, there can be some camaraderie around the pain and suffering of being a rule meister. And those of you in the audience who've been a rule meister, you're welcome to join that club. That should be our next Facebook group that we start, Rule Meisters of America Unite. Okay, so this requires some knowledge, actually we found, of the ontologies, because the ontologies actually have things that are partially overlapping semantic concepts in them. And they have pre-coordinations and post-coordinations that you can do. So you, in order to get equivalence, because the description logic only auto-classifies in 15% of the cases, sometimes you need to have multiple concepts from SNOMED to represent one idea, okay? And so it required some knowledge of SNOMED. And then we needed to know Boolean logic. People had to know something about symbolic logic in order to do it. We had to teach them if they didn't know it. And then something about if-then-else logic to do it. Not programming necessarily, but just, conditions, this conditionality. And you can either do it as a programmer might, or you can do it as conditionality as an epidemiologist might, and it would work, but you have to understand logic. So, okay, here's what we found. Okay. So here were the kappas for this, and they varied. On average, the inter-rater reliability, the percent agreement, was about 75%, almost 75%. If you look at it by group, one of the hypotheses we had was that people would be more in sync with the simple questions than with the hard questions. But what we found was that was not necessarily true, that the hard questions, they had just as good inter-rater reliability as they did with the simple questions. And we thought there were a couple things going on here. One was they got better at answering questions as they did more of them. So there was a learning effect. And that may have accounted for them. And they started with the simple ones, right? So that may have accounted for it, we think. Now, if you look at it, here's the percent agreements for these and the kappas. And this was the reference point overall when we compared the p-values. So they were not statistically significantly different. So our conclusions from this, one is we needed to improve the interface, and we've done that. And 75% is not horrible, right? I mean, it's not horrible, but it's certainly not what we were hoping for, We were hoping for much closer agreement from the scientists than that. And I've actually done this again with the trainees through our informatics courses in one of the lab sections. We make them author some of these rules, and we find that that they get better over time, and they realize the importance of learning to do this activity as part of their professional training. And so I think that in our workforce programs, one of the things we need to make clear to people is they need some training in logics. So we need to train people to make sure that subject matter experts have reliable methods for rules creation, and both on logic and ontologies, and then on the idea of computable case definitions. I think people need to have a formal training in how to do this in order to be good at it, so that we can start to get iterator agreement in the 90s where they should be. And then we need validation experiments that are needed to provide evidence that the case definitions actually provide the required sensitivity and specificity that people need to find them reliable for dissemination in public health. And so one of the things that we're implicitly sending a message to you about is when you create your own work in this field, where you create case definitions and you create models for healthcare that you are going to disseminate, you need to test them rigorously and know exactly what the confidence intervals are around any judgment that you may make from that data. Otherwise, you're sweeping your error under the rug. How many people use ICD-9 data for their research? Anybody here? Anybody? Come on. Oh, you won't admit it. Ooh, everybody knows. Okay, so anybody know what the error rates are for ICD-9 assignment? 23% in this country. They published the results in Europe are 40% for ICD-9. And then if you look at the we almost no article I've ever seen adds that variability into their into the calculations of significance that they use for ICD-9. As a matter of fact, I think it invalidates a good share of the medical literature, just that error rate. And we just sweep it under the carpet, you know. And I think we should have our error explicit and let us deal with it and make it better over time. And this sort of encourages you all to do that. So what am I trying to say? Well, usability studies are very important. They're useful mechanisms for objective evaluation. They're designed to answer specific questions, but they're also designed to discover new questions to answer, which I think is a very valuable part of the process in human factors engineering. And so, yeah, some people have told me they think this is real slide. I don't know. Anyway, so this we did. Brett and I did this experiment. So we decided we had a question. Somebody said, well, if you get the flu vaccine and you get the flu, are you partially protected or are you left, or are you completely left open, right? So you have the flu like everybody else. And we decided to try to answer this question by seeing what the complication rate, one common complication of influenza is pneumonia, right? So we said, what's the rate of pneumonia in people who've been vaccinated but get influenza versus the people who were not vaccinated for influenza and got influenza, right? And then we accounted for Pneumovax because we knew that was a confound, and we ran the data. And what we found was that actually, and we did this in 5 minutes, you know, with the parse data, all you have to do is make the query up and then answer the question. You can do it with the interface right in front of you. In the end, what we found was there was no difference in the rate of pneumonia between the people who had been vaccinated and got influenza and those that hadn't been vaccinated got influenza, accounting for the people who had gotten Pneumovax. So it was an interesting study. We thought that was pretty cool. And here's actually the data from that. And then we said, okay, well, that was easy because we can find pneumonia pretty easily in the chart. And it explodes and makes 169 types of pneumonia in SNOMED. And we had a lot of heads up, and it was a very powerful way to do it. So I said, well, let's do something that's a little more qualitative. So I said, okay, of the people who were smokers, how many were counseled to quit? And, you know, it was Mayo, this is Mayo data. We thought Mayo wanted, you know, very high numbers, prides himself on excellent healthcare, and only two-thirds were told to quit. And I'm sure they, you know, we all in our practice thought we were doing much better, thought we were in the 90s, you know, really, you know, if you come in, you have pneumonia, which is a pulmonary illness, right? We tell you, if you were a smoker, don't smoke, it's a bad thing, right? No, at least if we told them, we didn't document it a third of the time, which I think needs to be corrected. So we've worked on these technologies for a while, as Brett said, so this kind of intelligent electronic, intelligent NLP has a recall of 99.7% and a precision of 99.8%. So you can find, this is for clinical problems, so you can find the clinical problems very accurately, and that gives you a basis for comparison and keeps the confidence intervals small. And we use it for public health support. So we believe really that this kind of surveillance, because we're aggregating at the level of the concept, it gives you more complete data because we have lots of synonymy we can use. It's a fully automated approach that it's standards based, that we can Our view of NLP is a little different than other people. We don't figure a case definition, go out and find it. We parse everything we can out of the record first, and then we take the case definitions in the same language that we parse out of it and make those and hit against the record. So because it's a parse once, use many, the queries are much quicker. You don't have to go back to the data set and parse it again with the new question that you have. You've already got everything parsed out that you know how to parse out. So we believe that surveillance of clinical records can provide relevant and actionable data above and beyond of what we've done now, and that public health needs an accurate, fully automated mechanism for standards-based biosurveillance and situational awareness. So I'll just close with a couple of quick quotes. One's by Machiavelli, and I think there's a lot of us in the audience who suffer from this. That is that there's nothing more difficult to take in hand, he said in 1505, or more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things, because the innovator has for enemies all those who've done well under the old conditions, and only lukewarm defenders and those who may do well under the new. This is just as relevant to our discussions here during this conference as it was before. One of my favorite quotes is by Peter Drucker, which is the best way to predict the future is to create it, and I urge you all to help join with us and help create the future. Life is great, and I thank you very much for your kind attention. Do we take questions, or you want to? Oh, we do, I didn't think I had much time, so I kind of rushed. I'm sorry about that. Any questions or anything? Dan?
Peter,
yeah. Yes, sir.
With your experience with the National Quality Forum and their interest in e-measures, for example, how much uptake do you think they have on the type of strategy we've outlined here? Is that part of what the state is doing?
Yeah. So here's the thing. They haven't taken a line on technical strategy at all. But it's implicit. You see the little things that happen in government, right? So if you make the decision that you won't take just fixed field data and put it into your model of what you're going to surveil in your measures, then you've implied to the rest of us who have to implement them, both at the, you know, at the organizational level, state, local, and federal public health levels, that we have to account for this kind of detailed data, right? I mean, they're making that implication implicit. They know they're doing it, but they don't actually, because it's politically incorrect, say to the public that they have to do it. So what happens, the way this gets vetted, and you know this well, but for everybody who doesn't, is that the measures come up, they get voted on by the panel recommends them, they go out for public comment, and they also get commented on by ARC, which funds NQF, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Then once the public comment period is gone, the comments are vetted, and then the final measures are proposed, and they get put through ARC and then ratified or recognized by the secretary, right? Just like a HITSBI or ONC process. So ostensibly, people have the opportunity to say, no, we can't produce that. But there's so much volume of material that comes out that unless you're really an ardent interested party, you can't possibly go through all of it. You know, that said, you know, many of us in the community do make lots of commentary about what can be done, and then politically how this is implemented once it's regulated in this country is variable, because things that are regulated by the secretary are mandatory for government systems. So if the CDC was going to buy something, or if the VA wanted to buy something for their healthcare system, they would have to go along with these guidelines or rules mandatorily. But if Mount Sinai or Columbia or Utah wanted to do it a different way, there's no teeth in it for them. They can do whatever they want. And what CMS will do in terms of pulling that together is unclear, and also what the meaningful use criteria people will do in terms of that. Now, this is an aside, but it helps answer your question, and I think you'll be interested to know that as the quality measure, the quality information that was part of the meaningful use was put forward, it cites the interoperability specification from HITSBI. Now, you know, I was the co-chair at the time when we put out of Population Health, and we put that out, and that actually has exactly the same underlying architecture and structure that uses HL7 as what we showed you here. Not because we were being proprietary, but it's what we knew, you know, so we knew this would work, so we did it that way. And if you look at the architecture and the interoperability specification, it follows exactly what you guys are doing, what we're doing. It's SNOMED and CCD, also maybe CDA, they left that open, wrapper, and that is it also gives possibilities of using logics like Boolean logic and compositional expressions within it in order to express the measures and send them forward. In my view, it didn't quite go far enough because it didn't specify what logic system should be standard, so that anybody who had their own logic representation system that could encode this would be okay, which would mean that it's not truly machine interoperable. It might be more person interoperable. But we made a first step, a good step, I think, along the way. And I think as we start to use these and get more feedback from users, we'll realize that we have to drill down on the standards that have been given to the federal government from HITSB to try to make them less variable and more interoperable across organizations and in support of public health, local, state, and national. I tried to answer completely. I mean, thank you.
Very good.
Thanks. I tried. Sir. Yeah, of course.
I've been struggling with a lot of basic things, like using a standard course, very basic one, and snowman code. Also, do you have a kind of any idea of how long it would take to bring these kind of advanced things to the public?
Oh yeah, we do it already. Our work has been installed in your lab, which has been installed at the VA. We've been using it for 5 years, and we've got tens of thousands of patients' records, which is millions of records parsed. And we're using it for surveillance, very similar things. We're doing post-op complications, and we're modeling against the NSQIP criteria, which is a very famous data set that's nurse abstracted, trying to do that completely automatically. And that has a biosurveillance component, a PTSD, TBI component that Brett presented on. And then we've installed at Hopkins, been running there for 5 years, Mayo, and now Sinai, and we started to work with other universities too. Vanderbilt's got it. So we've got, it's very transparent to the organization because it can take the structure, if they have a structure, or it can take just plain free text and it'll structure it for you. And it just assumes you want the CDA format out of your structure, and it'll actually put it in that structure reliably so that you can use it in a knowledge-based format. So it's we didn't want people to have, and let me just say, it took me a good 20 years to understand this field with any reasonable competency. And I realized that when I start to train people, that and those of you who are adept at this know, it takes a real long time to understand ontologies, both the creation, use, the description logics well. And so I realized that we cannot be expecting everyone who's going to use our work to be expert in that area. If we're really a good field, we need to develop solutions that are black box, where they know what the input will be, know what the output will be, they know the confidence intervals around the answers that are given, and then after that, if they want to learn more, they get their PhD and get trained up to do it. But otherwise, it takes the burden off them to be experts in those logical fields. Thanks, Sunday, for that question. Appreciate it. Any other questions? I'd be happy to answer them. Anyway, sure. Hi. Did I pay you to? So I owe you $5. So Mike Matheny from our group, who's from Vanderbilt, you should hold out for 10, he's telling you. Yeah, that's probably right. It was a leading, I love it. So we had a poster here, actually. Mike Matheny, and actually Enlai, who's sitting right there next to you, wrote with us a program for the VAs. So we took 6 different VAs, and we parsed out the micro reports. Now, that's not so simple. So what we did was, it comes in a text format. So we had like 4 or 5 programs and cycles. So we put it in a standard structure, then we parsed the codes out of it, then we put it in a kind of spreadsheet-y field kind of way to get the organism, and there can be multiple for each culture, then the sensitivity for each of those organisms, what was tried against it for an antibiotic, what the MICs were, what the result of the sensitivity was, and then the date and time and all the administrative data that went along with that. And then what we did was we wrote a routine that went through it and found which ones were contaminated using the American College of Surgeons rules, which ones were contaminated specimens and which ones were real infections. Because, if you're going to do reporting and you're sending a lot of, commensurate data, like if you do a swab, if you get a report that says MRSA, it's not a real MRSA infection, almost never. If you did a report that says MRSA, they did a swab for MRSA to see if you're colonized. if you get Staph aureus and it's not sensitive to oxacillin or nafcillin, you got MRSA. I mean, so you have to know that level of detail in order to surveil for that kind of thing. So anyway, we did that and we got 90% for sensitivity specificity, and we're working on making it better. We've actually improved the role since the poster, and Mike Matheny, who's the principal investigator on that project from Vanderbilt, is part of the group here. He actually has a paper accepted to AMIA to present the results, and we'd be happy to share the system. Yeah, I mean, it's a cool and generalizable little thing that I think everybody needs, you know? So we're... Yeah. Right. And they're also Sure. That's another thing, but you know the NQF quality indicators include hospital association infections as one of the quality indicators, so it's going to be mandated too. So yeah. So I know. So anyway, that's one of the reasons we thought it was a good thing to do, and that's been completed. And completed meaning we've gotten a certain usable level of sensitivity and specificity, and we keep iteratively working on the design of these to catch the variability that we had not understood or were able to catch in the first round of this publication. So we're thinking, I don't know what you guys think, but we're thinking of delivering that as a web service so that instead of giving updates every time we have a better rule, you know, you just every time you get it, it just works a little better because, you know, we keep working on the rule. As we get more experience, we see more variability, and we account for that variability, and that increases the sensitivity and specificity of the tool. Is that seem like an okay way to do it for you guys? You'd be all right with that? Okay, good. That's what we're thinking. Any other questions or? Well, then I thank you for your kind attention. Appreciate your